This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 85 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as he always is Mike Morrison. Today, we are going to be discussing a fan-favorite episode of Deep Space Nine, The Visitor. And Mike, it's an episode that you suggested we talk about on the podcast today.
I did. You're absolutely right. This is a fan favorite. In fact, in 1996, the issue of TV Guide, it was voted best Star Trek show ever, which I think is really interesting considering at the time this was the least popular incarnation of Star Trek and it produced what at that time was considered the most popular show. I don't think it's necessarily the number one episode of Star Trek, but I think most fans, not everyone, I'm sure someone on the Babel Conference will have something to say in disagreement and dissent of this statement, but I think most fans would count it probably among their top 10, if not their top 20 episodes of Star Trek. And so it is a very popular episode. It's tearjerker. It's deep. It's emotional. I think for those reasons, fans tend to connect with it. But it's got a lot to say, I think, philosophically as well.
Are you saying it was rated higher than The City on the Edge of Forever?
I think it's definitely up there. But yes, in a 1986 issue of TV Guide, it was voted the best Star Trek show ever. No kidding.
Well, Mike, when you first suggested talking about The Visitor on Metatrex today, I was a little confused about what we might actually talk about. I had never admittedly really watched this episode from a philosophical perspective, so I really had to dive in and rewatch this episode and try to mine it for some good philosophical material, which is there, but it's such a touching, emotional episode that when I'd watched this episode previously, those had been the aspects of the episode that I emphasized in my mind that I remember and enjoyed about the episode. I hadn't really watched the episode from a philosophical perspective before.
Yeah, I think there's a lot there. I think identity over time certainly comes to mind, and how an event in one's life can affect the trajectory of his life. I think that's a very fascinating kind of touch point within the episode, certainly. We're dealing with subspace mechanics and time, and so there's all kinds of interesting things going on, I think, philosophically.
I'm particularly interested in your take on the writing theme inside the episode. At the very beginning of the episode, Jake Sisko, an aspiring young author, is fast at work on a short story, and Captain Sisko comes in and tries to tell him to, you know, poke his head up out of the pad that he's working on his story on. You know, poke your head up and look around. Life's happening. You can miss it if you don't stop and look around, he tells him. And Jake kind of reluctantly, you know, puts aside his story for the sake of going to observe this phenomenon with the wormhole up on the bridge. So one thing that comes immediately to my mind when I think about the role of writing and what it takes to be a good writer is what Heidegger would call being in the world, in der Welt sein, as he called it in German. This notion of being fully immersed in the world around you, and we do that through our projects we're involved in and things mm-hmm. we're working on and things we care about. But Jake needs a dose of being in the world to be a good writer. He's trying to write in the abstract about things that he hasn't experienced yet. And his father rightly says, poke your head up, look around, be part of the world. That'll help you be a better writer.
And he tells Jake, that's life. You know, that's life. And yeah, so I naturally, I gravitate towards this for that aspect. First of all, I really love and appreciate Jake's character because we get to see him uniquely of pretty much any character, I think, in the Star Trek universe. He comes to my mind as being one character that we really get to see a large slice of his life. I mean, when we first meet Jake, he's a young boy. And in this episode, we get to see him as an old man near death.
He's also like the anti-Wesley Crusher. Like, Wesley Crusher is like the Starfleet poster boy.
Yes.
And Jake Sisko has no interest in being in Starfleet. He wants to be a writer. It's almost wonderfully anachronistic in the 24th century.
Absolutely. In fact, when we see him in this episode, he's got his, you know, he's got his iPad and he's got his Apple Pen and he's kind of doing his thing. And that's when we first see him in the episode. He's writing away on a short story. And we get to meet another aspiring author in this episode in the character of Melanie, who is just divinely played by Andrew Garrick, Robinson's daughter. In real life, so we get to meet this character, and we get to see an author who has tasted success and one who's just starting out, and we get to see that kind of mentor type relationship even for the short while they have. And I love when she says to him, "You're my favorite author," and Jake says, "You need to read more."
As I was watching the episode, it occurred to me how very 20th century this episode actually is. The 20th century is filled with tales of the great American novel. Even in philosophy, we have philosophers like Jean-Paul Sartre, the 20th century existentialist mm-hmm. philosopher, who also was a novelist and a playwright, and wasn't just a philosopher in the pure sense, but somehow managed to intertwine being in the world in the existentialist sense with this creative activity of writing and literature and drama, but in a way that attempted to expose the reality of experienced life in the 20th century and the sort of internal emotional drama and the interpersonal tension between people and events in the world. And as I was watching the episode, it just occurred to me that this episode is kind of a natural consequence of the cultural trend in literature in the 20th century, everyone wanting to write the great American novel. And Sartre, the existentialist philosopher, didn't want to try to write the great American novel. He was French, of course. But the juxtaposition of philosophy and literature, or philosophy and novel writing, or philosophy and playwriting, that is an interesting intersection that happened in the 20th century. So as we sit back and go, well, what is the role of writing in philosophy? And what is the role of writing in being in the world? And vice versa, what's the role of experience in the world? You know, we're biological beings here in a physical world with experiences, and we can't help but incorporate those things into our writing. So what exactly is the relationship between philosophy and writing, or philosophy and being in the world, or writing and being in the world?
You know, it's interesting that you draw the comparison to Sartre. I tend to gravitate away from a writer like Sartre. I really think of Jake in terms of more like an Ernest Hemingway.
I was just thinking Hemingway, actually.
Yeah. I think there's a parallel there to be made in the way that Jake was writing for a paper, you know, during the Dominion War, much the same way Hemingway covered war in his time, and then took that experience and turned it into, I think, a career that really ranks him among some of the greatest novelists of all times. And I think one of the reasons why Hemingway is such a respected and celebrated novelist is because of that kind of hardcore, in the weeds experience that he got as a correspondent, you know, covering the harshness of war.
Yeah, there's definitely a parallel with Jake and his father being out there on the frontier, on the front lines of a war, and trying to incorporate the truth of the experiences of those events into his writing. And I think what's interesting about writing as a philosophical tool is its ability to expose something true about the world or about human nature or about our experiences. think of all the different masks we wear. In fact, we talked about this a couple of episodes ago on Metatrex when we were talking about the conscience of the king on the original series. Think about all the different masks that we wear in the course of life and interpersonal relationships and whatnot. There's something about drama and about literature that exposes the truth and can take the masks off and let those experiences and those facets of human nature be exposed for the world to see in a way that they can't always be in day-to-day interpersonal life. So I think of, in this sense, I kind of think of literature as a type of unmasking of reality.
I tend to agree with that. I know I have written for many years, going back even in my childhood, I enjoyed writing stories. And it's kind of interesting because when I was writing as a young man, I was writing from the abstract. I was writing from not so much of life lived, but life observed. And there's a big difference between life observed and life lived. And I think Jake is a young man when we first come to know him in this episode, who is writing from things that he observes in life. And we get to see him compacted inside these, I think maybe 42 minutes of this episode. We get to see his entire life lived, and we get to see how losing his father completely changed the trajectory of his life. And later on in life, he comes back to writing. I relate to that, Zachary, as a writer myself, because I wrote and I was passionate about writing. I loved telling stories, and oftentimes I was writing more from my observations than from my experiences. And then I got married and I got a career and I got busy with ministry and I had a child and I'm a parent, and now my child is in her teens and I'm a much older man now of 47, and I'm coming back to writing. And so I am kind of relaunching this dream that I had as a young man of writing a novel and having it published, and something that I'm very passionate about. But I've noticed as I've gone back and I've read and revisited things that I've written as a young man, that I write very differently now, and my experiences are woven into even my fictional stories in such a way that you would never recognize them from my own experiences, but how my experience colors the story. And so I think as an old man, Jake comes back to writing, and he writes with a different kind of perspective. It's a perspective of having lived his life. And I love the way that he's able to kind of pass not just his story, but his own wisdom. That thing that his father told him, poke your head up. He shares that with Melanie, and he says that from experience. Having not done so much in his early life. And I think there's something really beautiful about the way that's portrayed inside this episode.
Well, Mike, if you want to be the next Hemingway, you better jump on a plane and go run with the bulls in Pamplona or something.
I need to do something crazy like that.
I actually had a slightly different take on older Jake Sisko. Yes, he's older, he's more experienced, and naturally he draws on that experience when he writes. But I sense this sadness to him. I think he gets the sense that he hasn't actually really lived his life because he's spent so much time grieving his father, trying to get his father back from subspace, having given up writing for the sake of doing those things. Yes, he's returned to his writing as an older person. He has a new collection of stories. He gives a copy of that to Melanie. But I get the sense he really feels like he never actually lived his life, even though he technically has more experiences and is older.
Yeah, I don't disagree with what you're saying. Certainly, I see where you're coming from. But, I mean, let's face it. I think it's not so much that he didn't get to live his life. It's that He didn't get to experience, I think, the best version of his life. I think he lives his life with a great deal of regret that he lost his father. I think that he realized at a at a time in his life when, you know, life is coming to an end, that he didn't seize the day. I mean, there was just no carpe diem to his existence. I think that he rediscovered the passion that he once had for writing. He realized that that was a trajectory that wasn't just something he enjoyed doing, but it defined him. It was very much a part of who he was, and he had put everything on hold. I wouldn't say, go so far as to say that he didn't live his life, because I think certainly part of what he is passing on to Melanie here is this kind of sage wisdom. And I want to stop here for just a second and say that Tony Todd's portrayal of old Jake, I think, was brilliant, because what he brought to this role, I think, was that kind of sage prophet kind of feeling that you get from Benjamin Sisko, but he does it with the innocence of young Jake. And so you really feel like he's Jake, and you see a little bit of Jake, you see a little bit of Sisko, and you see him passing on this mantle to this young lady, and he's challenging her to really become the best version of herself, to not make the mistake of allowing things to get in the way of her realizing her dreams and doing the things that she wants to do. I think he realized that, you know, his marriage failed and his writing got put on hold. And, you know, here he is at the end of his life, and he's regretting the fact that he put down his pen and he let his wife walk out and all of these kind of things that have happened in his life, and he didn't have kids, and his, you know, there's Ben going, "Where's my grandbabies?" You know, and I love that. And all of a sudden it's like he snaps out of it and he realizes that I've been dragging this moment in time through life like an anchor, letting this moment in time, this event, hold me back from becoming the best version of myself. I think there's a lot of wisdom there. I think there's some philosophy to be mined.
Well, speaking of Tony Todd, did you know that Worf's brother Kern actually always secretly wanted to be a writer, the great Klingon novelist of the 24th century? Little known fact about Worf's brother.
But alas, he picked up the batleth and went into the family business to become a warrior.
Leave the pen, take the batleth.
He wields a deadlier pen now.
The pen is mightier than the batleth, is what you're saying. I honestly don't know what to make of the sage wisdom that older Jake Sisko passes down to Melanie. On the one hand, I feel like it's from lived experience. He is older and he's wiser. On the other hand, I feel like he's passing on kind of second person wisdom. He was handed wisdom from his father that he didn't take advantage of, and he's passing that on, which is great. But I still feel this sadness in him, like he's kind of wasted his life. He never did actually poke his head up out of those books.
I think the sadness that we feel from Jake really is this kind of unresolved thing from his past. I mean, he's literally being haunted by the ghost of Sisko past.
And a living apparition.
A living apparition. I mean, literally, it's a haunting of sorts, in that he is dragging his father through time, and his father keeps popping up at these moments and, you know, basically grabbing him by the shoulders and saying, "Jake, live your life." That seems to be his message. "Jake, live your life, live your life." And at the end of his life, you know, when Jake realizes that, you know, it's this grand theory that he has, that if I can cut the cord, if I can, you know, and cutting the cord is, it's interesting that they use that analogy here, because in many ways we talk about pulling the plug, you know, in terms of assisted suicide, and Jake is pulling the plug more or less on himself in order to cut the cord for his father. And so in doing so, he believes that Ben Sisko would return to the point of the accident, and he's absolutely right at the end of the episode. But it's an incredible risk, and Ben Sisko recognizes that risk. I agree that there's sadness there, but I think the sadness is a sadness that is linked to this unresolved moment in time. And really, it's like father, like son. Jake, much the same way that Ben Sisko was still living back there on that ship at Wolf 359, Jake is still living his life on the Defiant in that engine room there in at the wormhole. And he is anchored to that moment in time. And it's robbed him of his joy. It's stolen his hopes and his dreams. And he's allowed it to hold him back from becoming, I think, the best version of himself. And I think that sadness that we see is as much about that unresolved moment in time as it is about the fact that he recognizes he didn't live up to the promise that his father saw in him as a boy.
See, I think this is a great example of how something fictional, literature or television in this case, can expose something true about human nature. I don't know if other people are like this, but I feel like this sometimes. I feel like there are unresolved moments of sadness from the past that Sure. are still there that you've never quite moved beyond. Yes, you move on, life happens, and you live the rest of your life, but emotional things or situations from the past that are unresolved that are always present in some way. And having those experiences or those unresolved moments of sadness from the past color all of your perceptions of the present or future events. You know, we don't spend much time talking about those things, but I can certainly relate to that aspect of Jake Sisko. And I think the story does a great job of revealing that part of human nature.
I can as well. And I agree with what you said wholeheartedly. And Jake says as much in the episode as he's talking to Melanie. You know, he makes the observation that, you know, time passed and people began to move on. People began to live their lives again. You know, he kind of recounts the memorial service, and he talks about, you know, kind of Dax taking Jake under her wing, and he talks about, you know, life kind of, you know, getting on at the station. And over the passage of time, we see, you know, things happening like the Klingons coming in and so forth and so on. You know, time moved on, but in Jake's mind, at the very end, he is still that boy. In fact, the inscription, the dedication in his manuscript that he gives to Melanie, the inscription reads, "To my father who's coming home." I think that's really revealing in the episode, because I think even though we see a much older Jake, again, much the same way that Ben Sisko at the beginning of Deep Space Nine had spent the last couple of years still living in that moment at Wolf 359, Jake lived an entire life, and there he sits, though he is an old man and gray. And Ben Sisko makes the observation a couple of times in the episode that he's gotten older. "You're older than I am," he says. He's still the boy that he was, who still misses his father, who still regrets what happened. And maybe to some degree, he feels responsible as well. I can certainly relate to a lot of the things in this episode. This is like, you know, deep space tissues here in this episode, but
deep space tissue.
It's one of those very emotional stories that I think anyone who's had a relationship with their father, or a lack of relationship with their father, who has, in my case, I didn't have a very good relationship with my father in the last few years of his life. We had a great relationship, and I was sitting at his bedside when he passed, and it has crept up many times in my adult life as I look back, sometimes with regret for what wasn't, and there are moments when I look back very glad that we had those last few years to forge a relationship, and I was glad to have been there and been able to hold his hand. But you know, I have moments when in my mind, in my heart, I go back to the boy that I was, and I lament the moments that never were because of resentment for him and you know, for the childhood that you know that I had. My father was not a particularly good father, and so you know I look back on those and I'm sad sometimes. But you know, frankly, life has taught me not to live in the past, and so I try to be for my daughter the father that I didn't have growing up. Every day, I try to be all there in the moment with her in some way to be at least a little bit more of the father that I wished I had. So I relate to this immensely. This is an emotional episode. Sometimes I've got to be honest. I've seen the episode probably a dozen times at this point, and there have been times that I have literally had to get the deep space tissues and just kind of cry along with it. And you know, there have been moments I've been able to watch it and you know, kind of explore the characters a little bit more and not think so much about the emotional aspects. But you know, I certainly see you know that it's there and it's very much a part of the episode as a whole.
As I think about what this episode means philosophically, it occurred to me that it's largely an exercise in the phenomenology of human experience in a number of different ways. Phenomenology in the sense of revealing things that are true about our experience. Not so much metaphysically about the world as it really is, but the world as we experience it more subjectively. And there are things that are true subjectively about our experience. There are also things that are true psychologically about us, and I think this episode reveals certain things about our psychology. But in terms of phenomenology, I think this episode does a pretty good job of capturing certain facets of human experience. It touches on the experience of aging. It touches on the experience of regret. It touches on the experience of feeling a metaphysical connection with someone. It touches on the experience of being in a parent-child relationship. It touches on a number of different facets of human experience. And is that philosophy? I think, you know, philosophers disagree about whether that really counts as philosophy, right? Some philosophers are like, oh no, if we're not talking about reality in itself in some metaphysical sense or getting some deep ethical, you know, moral conundrum, then this doesn't really count as philosophy. But I think if you look at philosophy from the 20th century existentialist perspective, then all of these things reveal certain truths about ourselves and mm-hmm. about our experience in the world, the experience of being in the world and being involved in a network of these different kinds of interpersonal relationships and what they mean and how they affect us. And I think this episode is really valuable from that perspective, if not, you know, strictly speaking, from a metaphysical perspective.
Yeah, and you mentioned metaphysics, and I think there's certainly some abstract, at least in the abstract, metaphysics inside this episode that I'm sure that we'll dive into here in a moment. But yeah, strictly in terms of you know looking at the phenomenology of experiences, this is really chock full, and I think it's one of the reasons why it's such a fan favorite, because I think there's something here inside this episode that virtually anyone can relate to. And this is so quintessential Star Trek. There's no pew pew in this episode. There's no, in terms of, this isn't an alien of the week kind of thing. There's none of that going on. There nary a phaser is fired. And yet we are lured. Yeah,
the Klingons came with pens instead of batleth in hand.
No blood was shed, but they spilled the ink. Kapla. Today is a good day to write.
You got any more there, Mike?
I can do this
Keep
all
up,
night.
You're on a roll.
I can do this all night.
Bada bing, bada bing.
But I think that's what makes this such a quintessential kind of Star Trek episode. You know, you made reference earlier, and maybe it was in the Turbo Lift, to City on the Edge of Forever. This is very much a City on the Edge of Forever type of an episode, in that we're drawn into this emotional story, but in such a Star Trek fashion, it reveals so much about human nature that we just can't walk away from it unchanged, unaffected. You can't just walk away from this episode and go, eh, meh. I don't know. Maybe you can, but evidently in 1996, most Star Trek fans couldn't because they said it was the best ever. So,
well, speaking of metaphysics, I do want to talk a little bit about the metaphysics of the episode, not in any sort of Star Trek technobabble kind of sense, but clearly in this episode, Jake Sisko and his father are bound in some way, they're tethered together in subspace, whatever that means, right?
Yeah.
And so that got me thinking about this notion that people can be metaphysically connected in some way. Certain people view that about relationships or about marriage, right? This notion that you're joined together in some mm-hmm. deeper metaphysical sense. If you have a religious worldview, you might think of that in some way. So right off the bat, one question I have is this a real phenomenon? Are people ever metaphysically connected to each other in some non-spatiotemporal kind of way? Does that ever actually occur? And if so, what does that mean? I don't have the answer to that, of course, but I think it's an interesting question. You know, some people really do think that's part of reality, and some worldviews hold that's part of reality. Mm-hmm. But I'm also interested in the phenomenology of that experience. What does it mean to feel metaphysically connected to someone? I think that's part of romance. It's part of courtship. It's part of friendship. It's part of being connected to family, this feeling of a special connection with individual people. So two questions, you know, is there ever any kind of metaphysical connection in the non-spatiotemporal sense, whether it's subspace tethering or otherwise? And then what does it mean to have that experience of whether that metaphysical connection is real or not? What does it mean to feel that kind of metaphysical connection?
I think those are excellent questions, and they're questions that we've been trying to answer for eons. And it's interesting because when you talk about kind of this idea of metaphysical connection, I immediately think of some of the science that we have on the books as it relates to twins. I think have provided some of the most interesting, I think, results in terms of trying to quantify whether two people can be metaphysically connected. The really interesting things out there in terms of the science behind that. And in many ways, with this phenomenon, this kind of twin phenomenon, we have real quantifiable evidence that it's quite possible that two people can be metaphysically tied together.
I don't want to be accused of giving an argument for extrasensory perception, which is almost what it sounded like you were doing for a moment. Some astute listener out there will be like, oh yeah, if that stuff's real, where's the footnotes? Cite the studies.
But I'm not. I'm just, as I said, I'm not making an argument for it either way. I'm simply saying that this has been something that has been argued and it has been researched, and there is evidence that could suggest really both conclusions. And so in that, I find that fascinating.
Yeah, I probably put myself more in the skeptic category about any deeper metaphysical connection. But mm-hmm. what I do have a lot of experience of is the phenomenology of that, the feeling of having a special connection to people, whether they're people from the past or past relationships or mm-hmm. whatever. There are certain people I would cite and say, no matter where they are in space and time, some living, some dead, some near, some far, that there's always a special connection there for me. And that's part of my experience, not part of my worldview. I don't really think those metaphysical connections exist per se in the fabric of reality. But I think that the experience, well, how to put it? But I think that the language of metaphysical connection is helpful for capturing the sentiment of those types of experiences. Just like the subspace tether is a great metaphor for this special connection between Jake and his father, whether or not subspace tethers really exist.
Precisely. And
I guess my point is just that whether or not this kind of deeper metaphysical connection between individuals is real or not, there is a metaphorical truth to that kind of language that we should retain, that we shouldn't try to get rid of just because we don't think they really exist.
Yeah, I think that's well put. And again, I love the metaphor, and I'm an author who likes to use metaphor in my own stories. So I really do love the metaphor of this subspace tether, because I think any Deep Space Nine fan could sit down and do a rewatch and watch their way through these seven seasons of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And I've admitted before, I was late to the game. I didn't watch Deep Space Nine in its first run. I was one of those sourpuss fans who, you know, this isn't real Star Trek. It's not on a ship, and it's not Enterprise. And
well, you were a grumpy old man 20 years ago.
I was a grumpy old man 20 years ago, and so I didn't come to Deep Space Nine until late in the game. And I'm so sorry now that I did. I've lived my life with regret, and I'm currently studying subspace mechanics to try to figure out how to go back and change that. But just in case that I don't, I'm just going to confess it now. I'm really glad that I took the time. I've done four complete series rewatches of this series, and it's buying the original series Enterprise, and I would say Deep Space Nine. I absolutely love it, and I love the fact that there is this very unique relationship that exists in this series between Benjamin Sisko and his son. It's something that you don't get in any other Star Trek iteration of Star Trek, is this relationship between a father and a son. And I think it's fantastic. And I'm really glad that they did an episode like this where they have a metaphor for that connection that they have, because this father and son do share, I think, a very tender, special bond. And it's very unique in science fiction, period, but certainly in Star Trek.
I think what's interesting about this phenomenology of feeling like there's a metaphysical connection to another person is kind of the juxtaposition of how persistent it is, the sense that it's always there, it's omnipresent, it's something that never quite goes away, and yet how fleeting those moments that reveal that really are. You know, people do come and go, and events in our lives come and go, and that the touch points in time, for lack of a better word, mm-hmm. are so fleeting, even given the persistence of that perception of a connection to other people.
You know, one of the things that I note in this episode is the way their relationship just picks up, you know, when he appears out of nowhere immediately, and time isn't passing for him. We find that out within the episode. So time's not passing for him, but for Jake, you know, many years go by between these experiences that he has where he sees his father. And so, interestingly enough, while time isn't passing for Ben, time is passing for Jake, but his life isn't really advancing. And we've talked plenty about that already, but I think that it's really interesting in this episode the way that their relationship just picks up, just like really in some ways they're back there on the Defiant. Ben Sisko's first question's always, tell me, you know, don't worry about them, Jake. They'll get here when they get here. Talk to me. How's life? How's your wife? Do I have any grandbabies yet? I love the fact that you're still living in the home. And Jake is, again, reduced to, a puddle. You know, he's digging into the deep space tissues, and he is suddenly that teenage boy again, facing the fact that he lost his father. So really, in some ways, for both of these guys, their relationship is so unique in the way that it just kind of picks up. And I said that to say this: there are people in my own life that no matter how much time passes, when I see them or I talk to them, it's like all the years didn't happen. And we just click, we just pick up and we go on. We're, you know, in the case of friends from college, we're college kids again. I've got friends that, you know, have been friends of mine since we were teenagers. And when we talk, we're just, you know, we're two teenage boys again. It's like nothing, all, you know, 20, 25, 30 years. It's time hasn't passed in some respects. And I won't say that for every relationship that I've had in my life, but I find that interesting. And certainly there's that type of thing going on here in this episode between Jake and his dad.
It's almost as if this episode does a better job of capturing the phenomenology of friendship than of a parent-child relationship. Mm-hmm. The kind of experiences you describe with friends, many years passing and still feeling like you have the same connection, you fall back into the same rhythms with people. That's an important part of deep, close friendships. And that's essentially what's happening in the episode. No time passes for Captain Sisko. Although his time is passing for Jake, so it's kind of a one-sided friendship in that way. But generally, I think that's an important part of a good close friendship, this ability to pick right back up where you left off, even after many years.
Yeah, and I think that can go negative as well. A friend of mine comes to mind. I didn't have great relationships with my parents, so it's hard for me to reflect upon having that kind of bond with a parent. But a friend of mine mentioned to me once that every time he goes back to his hometown and he sees his mother, you know, it's always the same thing with her. It's, you know, you're not married yet. And
it's like time never passes for mom.
It's like time never, it's always the same conversation. And he says she tells the same stories and she asks me the same questions. And so I think that can go negative as well. Somewhere out there, one of our listeners is going, yeah, you know, my mother never lets me forget the time that, and she never lets me forget that I'm not this. And so I think that can go both ways. Fortunately for Jake and his dad, it's a very positive thing, even though there's this very negative experience that are kind of holding these two men together inside this episode.
Some listeners out there actually think that about us every time we have a new episode. It's like no time has passed. Always the same jokes, always the same rhythms, always the same conversation.
It's the same old, same old.
Same old Metatrex, no matter how much time has passed.
It's the Zach and Mike show. 85 times now.
Are you saying we're metaphysically connected, Mike? Do we have a subspace tether here?
It's a subspace tether, and it tenses and pulls us back together, you know, sometimes once a week, sometimes twice a month, you know, and 3 months can pass, and well, there we are.
I think we forget how magical of a time we really live in. This ability to instantly communicate with each other on video, recording a podcast with our microphones, with satellites connecting us and wires and electricity. And there's this interesting network of invisible stuff connecting us, allowing us to have this conversation. That would have seemed like magic 150 years ago, and now it's part of our reality. We don't think of it as metaphysical, but it sure would have looked metaphysical 150 years ago.
I think it would have been perceived as darn near magical in the 1970s and 80s as I was growing up. And never in my wildest dreams did I ever think that I would count among my friends someone who lives in Vacaville, California that I've never met in my life face to face. You know, we met. And we've recounted this. We've regaled our listeners with this tale many a time.
Do so again, Mike.
But, you know, you and I met on a panel discussion for Patrons Roundtable. And we had similar intuitions about these kind of deeper, you know, these meta issues of Star Trek. And you were thinking, you know, I'd like to do a podcast about philosophy and Star Trek, and I'm trying to figure out how I can, you know, do something where I can have these deeper conversations about Star Trek. And, you know, you pinged me one day and said, hey, would you like to do a podcast? And the rest is history.
Isn't that how most podcasts start? Hey, do you want to do a podcast with me?
Sure. But here I am in Texas and there you are in California. I've not done the math, but I'm sure there are at least 1,000 miles between us and a few years, and never in my wildest dreams as a young boy or young man in the 70s and 80s would I believe that was possible. So that seems like magic. But here, you know, with these subspace tethers that we call the information superhighway, you and I are able to have a Zoom chat and share notes and collaborate and create this podcast now 85 times for our listeners, hopefully for their enjoyment.
Yes, we've popped out of subspace 85 times.
It's incredible.
Like whack-a-moles. Subspace whack-a-moles. I've always been fascinated by this invisible connection, mainly about modern communication. Some listeners know this, but I'm a ham radio operator too, which I don't do much anymore. But I grew up, you know, using Morse code and talking to people with a microphone around the world using radio. And I've always thought that was magical because it's invisible. You know, this notion that these two individuals on the other side of the world can be talking to each other when there's nothing visible connecting them. It always seemed magical and interesting and quasi-metaphysical to me.
Yeah, and here we're adding these additional layers of video and this collaborative thing that we do as we develop these episodes of our podcast where we can
cross out my show notes. Like, that's such a bad idea. Don't put that in there.
It seems very common for us today, but when you look at it in terms of a long period of time, you know, when this accident happened and Benjamin Sisko was drug into subspace, Jake assumed that he had been killed. That was everyone's assumption. He was killed by whatever discharge had come out of the warp core. And it's interesting that as time passes and they grow an understanding, and who knows what discoveries are yet to be made in our own world and what will our world look like in communication and relationships? What will those things look like 20 years from now, 40 years from now? You know, who knows? But I think it's interesting times that we live in, that we can make these connections. They're not subspace tethers and we're not dragging each other through life, but you know, we can certainly use them for good and build relationships and get to know people and have, I think, constructive dialogue about philosophy, about Star Trek, about things that we share in common. And I think it's fantastic. And you know, inside this episode, I think Jake's desire is to, he goes back to school and he learns subspace mechanics and he tries to do something good with that knowledge. Who knows? I think the sky's the limit.
Well, speaking of Jake and his study of subspace mechanics, his ultimate goal is to find a way to cut the cord, as he calls it inside the episode. I just found this an interesting bit of language. It's very self-sacrificial. He's literally going to commit suicide to cut the cord, to break the tether between himself mm-hmm. and his father. I was struck by the language of it mainly. This phrase, cutting the cord, is often used to describe parents letting children go. And here it's kind of being used in the opposite sense. We have Jake, even though he's an old man, he is the child in the parent-child relationship, cutting the cord to let his father snap back in time to where he's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I referenced, you know, the language of pulling the plug. You know, we use that, you know, we pull the plug on somebody.
Jumping the shark. Oh, wait, sorry, wrong metaphor.
But in this episode, there's some very interesting language associated with that. And I think it's fascinating because, you know, at the end of the episode, Jake, who is the son, is much, much older than Ben Sisko, and he's going to cut the cord. I'm not sure if there's anything significant about that, but I thought at least the language was interesting. But much more than that is this exploration, this idea that by ending his own life, he was somehow, you know, freeing his dad. And his theory proved to be true in that his father was able to return to the moment of the accident, and they were given another chance. And, you know, that touching scene at the very end when he embraces his son says, you know, are you okay? And he says, I am now, Jake. And back into the deep space tissues they go, I am now. and they have that touching moment. But they're given this incredible second chance to live their lives. And Jake obviously has no recollection of it, but, you know, it does appear at least that Ben Sisko does. So, you know, what does that mean for the two of them? You know, time can only tell.
In a way, it's an odd type of self-serving self-sacrifice that Jake does. On the one hand, he's trying to cut the cord to send his father back in time to kind of save his father and break his father out of subspace. But he's also doing it for the benefit of his younger self, right? His younger self is going to be back there in time and have the experiences with his father he didn't get to have as an older person. So is it really altruistic or is it more self-serving? It looks like a kind of self-sacrifice, but it's a very self-serving self-sacrifice, I think.
Yeah, I think it's more self-serving. And I say that because, again, when he reads the inscription of the manuscript to my father, who's coming home, and Ben says to him, I don't, you know, it's great, but I don't understand. And Jake says to him, for you and for the boy that I was. And then he goes on to say, he needs you more than you know. Don't you see? We're going to get a second chance. And then he dies. Yeah, I think it is very self-serving, but at the same time, you know, his life's ambition was to free his dad from this quasi-prison that he's in, this kind of subspace no man's land that looks a whole lot like, you know, the same place where they go to meet the prophets. So,
and the Q Continuum.
And the Q Continuum. Yes, it's an old school kind of Apple commercial going on there near the end of the episode, and Jake comes out of it once again in tears. But I think there's something self-serving about it. But if it's self-serving that he wants to have a second chance with his dad, but he also wants to fulfill this lifelong quest to free his father from this quasi-prison, then yeah, it's all of the above.
Well, I think the willingness to quote-unquote cut the cord is an important part of feeling any kind of connection with other people, right? Sometimes you have to do that, and you know you're still connected in some way, but sometimes people do have to cut the cord with each other for the sake of having their own lives or having their own experiences, or
sure,
if it's a relationship, if you're not a good match, or whatever it is, right? Cutting the cord is an important part of having that kind of connection with someone in the first place. It's not quite a logical consequence of that kind of connection, but it certainly is a common experience in that kind of connection between people.
Well, and I alluded to this before, the fact that this event, this subspace loop, this kind of backfeed, this arc that in the episode strikes Ben Sisko, this moment in time completely changed Jake's trajectory in life. And I think he recognizes that, certainly as an old man. I think he recognizes that because let's face it, as an 18-year-old, he says at the beginning of the episode when he's talking to Melanie, he said he was 18. So, you know, at 18 years old, I thought I knew what I wanted to be and what I wanted to do in life, and life happens, and I'm certainly not anywhere that I believed that I would be when I was 18 years old. You go back in time and tell my 18-year-old self, you know, where I am and what I'm doing, I'd be like, you know, no way, because you think you know the direction you're going to go in life, and then life ends up happening. And you know, sometimes it's good things that happens, and sometimes it's bad, but you know, your trajectory gets pushed in one direction or another. These things happen in your lives, in our lives. We our parents pass, or maybe it's a grandparent that we were close to. You know, maybe it's getting married, maybe it's having a child, maybe it's a friendship that fell apart in a very bad way. Maybe it was a bad relationship that somehow scarred you, and now you're 50 years old, you're sitting at home, in your t-shirt, and you're eating a bag of chips, and you're alone because you gave up on relationships, whatever the case may be. You know, I think that this episode has this interesting perspective about how...
Did you just say all that in a bag of chips?
All that in a bag of chips. Absolutely. All that in a bag of... All that I just said.
I thought I heard
and
that.
You got the bag of chips, and you're eating them and you're alone, and it's all because of a bad experience with a relationship. So I said that to say this, you know, I think this episode really encompasses how events in our lives can alter and change our trajectory, and the power that we give those experiences to do that really, I think, is up to us. We can You know, I say to my wife all the time, when negative things happen in life, and we've certainly, you know, in almost 24 years of marriage, you know, we've experienced some difficulties in life. You know, we've had some challenges, just like, you know, anyone. And I say to her all the time, you know, we have a choice here. We can allow this to make us bitter, or we can allow this to make us better. And, you know, I do the best I can in life to allow the negative things to try to make me a better person. But, you know, I know for many people, they are holding on to hurts. They're holding on to pain, and they're dragging it through life like an anchor, and it's holding them back from being the best version of themselves. I say to you, if you identify with that statement in any way, shape, or form, grab a box of Deep Space tissues, sit down, and watch this season 4 episode of Deep Space Nine, and just believe that, you know, you don't have to go through life lamenting the past. You can become the best version of yourself.
I thought you were going to say something slightly different there. I thought you were going to say, if you're feeling like you're being dragged by an anchor, then grab your batwith and cut the cord.
Grab your batwith, cut the cord, let it go. Yeah, and I think we see Jake giving Melanie that kind of sage advice, telling her that, you know, go out there and live life. Poke your head up. That's what my father told me. Poke your head up. It's called life. And you know, if you'll miss it if you don't open your eyes.
Well, I want to bring this discussion full circle. Speaking of Melanie, we started out the discussion talking about the role of writing and being in the world. And Melanie asks older Jake a really important question. Why did you stop writing? You weren't even 40 when you stopped writing. Mm-hmm. And so to me, this begs an interesting question about the role of change over time as we age, as we change, as we get older. There are things in my life that I know make me happy, that are part of who I am, that I'm really good at, that I don't do much anymore. I don't do much ham radio stuff. I don't build electronics like I used to. I used to teach philosophy, and yes, I do Meditrex with you, but I don't do much philosophy anymore. I don't read much philosophy. I don't write much philosophy. I do Meditrex. That's how I do my philosophy. But those were things that I was good at that I don't do anymore. You can plausibly say, I can picture someone like Melanie looking at me saying, why don't you do those things anymore? Why don't you jump on the ham radio? Why don't you build some electronics project? Why don't you teach a philosophy class at a community college once in a while? Why don't you do those things? Why did you stop? You were so good at those things. I don't have a satisfactory answer to that. My only answer is that circumstances have changed. Life has moved on and my interests have changed and I've changed and I just don't do those things anymore like I used to. It's not a very satisfactory answer, just like Jake's answer is not terribly a satisfactory answer as to why he stopped writing.
Yeah, I relate to that inside this episode, the way that Jake goes back to writing later in life.
Well, there's a kind of trauma that happens inside the episode. Jake has been traumatized, and that trauma has led to him kind of losing touch with himself, yeah, literally in some way, to the point where he's given up on the thing that he's good at and enjoys doing and adds meaning to his life, and he stopped doing it because of this traumatic experience when he was a teenager.
I think it's interesting, too, that when he ceased being the best version of himself, when he let go of that one thing that I think really makes Jake unique, certainly in the Star Trek universe, as we've mentioned already here on the podcast, this is so unique to the Star Trek universe. He's a writer, and that's what Jake is. Jake, when you think of Jake Sisko, I think it's very difficult to think of him without, you know, without being able to define him as a writer. It's what makes him unique. And when he quit being who he was, everything else kind of fell apart in his life. And people that he was close to pulled away. And, you know, it affected everything. It affected his life's trajectory. And it affected his relationships. And, you know, there he is, you know, kind of coming back to himself at the end of the episode. And I can't say enough about just how interesting and deep this episode really is, and how far it can take you into yourself in this kind of examination of self and how events in our lives can change us. You mentioned identity over time. I think that really is kind of the central philosophical theme. Really, if you're looking for, you know, that main philosophical theme in the episode, I think change over time,
the non-fluffy phenomenological theme.
Yeah, exactly. I think is really at the heart of this. It's about defining Jake Sisko.
Well, to Jake's credit, older Jake's credit, he rediscovers writing. He gets back in touch with himself, and he does end up writing more stories. It's not really clear in the episode why exactly he starts writing again. Did you get that sense from the episode?
Not really.
But that does match my experience of getting older over time. There are parts of myself that are important parts of myself. Sometimes they fall by the wayside because of circumstance or a change in interests or a change in personality. But sometimes I look inward and I rediscover those things about myself, whether it's personality traits about myself or whether it's interests that I have that I've lost interest in that I want to rekindle, whatever it is. There's this kind of ongoing, somewhat cyclical process of falling away from yourself and rediscovering yourself.
There's an observation that I have to make before we bring this conversation to any kind of closure, and that is to say that when Jake did rediscover himself, when he kind of went back to the very best version of himself and he rediscovered who he is, this thing that haunted him, trying to solve this puzzle as to what to do to free his dad from this prison, it came to him. And it was when he went back to focusing on what he loved and what he was passionate about that this thing that had come to consume him was solved. And I really think that there's an interesting message there. I think that being our most authentic selves really is the key to solving life's problems and discovering all the things I think that we look for in life that we're missing. It really can be found when we truly become the most authentic version, our most authentic selves. So to answer your question as best I can as to, you know, what caused him to go back to writing, I really think it was, I think it was a wake-up call when he tried to reverse the accident on the Defiant, in that wonderful scene with old Dax and old Bashir. I think it was that moment and, you know, his dad's advice, you know, promise me that you're going to live. Promise me, you know, promise me. It was kind of this Dickens moment inside of it's Deep Space Dickens. And the ghost of Christmas Present will be played by Ira Stephen Bear. So I think it was that advice that Ben Sisko gave him, live your life. You know, I think he woke up and he did, and he realized that, I'm midway through life's journey. His dad said, you're older than me, Jake, that he suddenly rediscovers himself.
Well, we didn't talk much about the Defiant crew getting back together for one more ride on the Defiant, pulling the Defiant out of mothballs.
Yeah, I agree. We should talk about this.
Do you think one of these years, like 30 years from now, we're going to get the band back together and do one more episode of Metatrex?
I think we should.
No, there's kind of like an aging rock star component to this, right? Let's get the band back together. One more concert, one more tour. Like, what exactly is the difference between rediscovering your identity and your authenticity and your interests and being an aging rock star with a midlife crisis? There's a very fuzzy line there. Fire those phasers one more time! One thing I love about the depiction of the older Defiant crew as they get the band back together for one more ride on the Defiant is that they all have the same banter with each other. Yes, it's 30 years later or however many years it's supposed to have been, but they have the same ribbings of each other, the same kinds of jokes, and it's the same people just 30 years later. But that's an example of this phenomenology of friendship. You get the same group of people back together, they're close friends, and it's like no time has passed.
Yeah, that is really fascinating. Although there are fans who really, this is the part of the episode that they tend to pick at, because, you know, Dax didn't die in the Bajoran temple. So is Bashir Super Bashir, genetically altered Bashir or not? The Dominion War didn't happen. So this is the part that I think fans sometimes get a little touchy about, are these inconsistencies with how the story unfolded. But honestly, I think that there's something to be said there for how events that can seem seemingly benign in the grand universe that maybe affect a small group of people or a person can really have exponential effects in the universe. And I think it's very plausible that Benjamin Sisko could have been the catalyst that started the war and certainly the reason why it was ended. So who knows, Zachary? Who knows what catastrophic thing might be averted because we recorded an 85th episode of Metatrex? You just never know.
Certainly this episode will do some good to someone out there in the podcast verse.
So, Zachary, we are well over the 1 hour mark. Any final thoughts on The Visitor as we wrap things up today?
I think what's been interesting for me about talking about this episode on Metatrex is that I never viewed this episode from a philosophical perspective before. Yes, it's a very touching episode. It's an emotional episode. It's an introspective episode. But it's never one that I associated much with philosophy. But as I rewatched it before we recorded today, I was struck by the theme of writing and the relationship of writing to this notion of being in the world that we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, mm-hmm. that to be a good writer, you have to be immersed in your experiences and immersed in the world and immersed in things. And that immersion and that writing and reflection about that immersion in the world can reveal certain things that are true about the world of human experience. Again, not true in some deep metaphysical sense, but true of the world that we inhabit, that we care about, that we are immersed in. I'm also struck by the way this episode reveals certain things about human experience phenomenologically, this notion of being metaphysically connected to another person, which I can relate to and has been a part of my life. The notion of aging, the experience of being in a parent-child relationship, the experience of regret, the experience of losing your authenticity and trying to regain it. There are so many different parts of human experience that are captured inside this one episode, all of which have a tinge of sadness to them, I think, interestingly enough. So I think whether you find this episode philosophically interesting has something to do with your view about what philosophy means. If philosophy means metaphysics, you know, reality in itself, apart from the subjective experience of reality, then this episode is not very philosophical. If philosophy means an interesting ethical or moral dilemma, then that's not what's going on in this episode, and this episode is not going to be terribly philosophically interesting. But if you're a product of the 20th century and you think that trying to write the great American novel and being immersed in the world and using literature and drama to expose parts of reality, to be introspective phenomenologically, to be preoccupied with the notion of who you are and what your responsibility for things is in a 20th century existentialist kind of way, then you'll find this episode very interesting phenomenologically. Whether it's Heidegger's notion of being in the world or whether it's Sartre's notion of trying to write a philosophical novel, I think if those things count as philosophy, and they certainly do to some people, then this episode is very rich philosophically and phenomenologically. But if you're one of those people who thinks of philosophy in a very narrow sense, and I know some of you are out there and I know some of you are listening, then you're not going to think this episode is terribly philosophically interesting. But if you think the phenomenology of lived experience and being in the world is interesting, then I think there's a lot of interesting material that properly counts as philosophy inside this episode.
And I'm going to count myself among those people who find this episode very interesting philosophically. I mentioned that I think that the overall theme philosophically in this is identity over time. You know, we get to see really inside a 42-minute episode, really virtually a man's entire life, Jake's life from 18 years old. We got to see him for four seasons before that. So, you know, when we first meet Jake, he's barely a teenager. And now, you know, he's 18 at the beginning of this episode. And we really, in many ways, get to see the sum total of his adult life in many respects. And so I find that really interesting to see how his identity changed from the boy that we met inside that premiere episode to the 18-year-old that we discovered at the beginning of this episode and the man that he ultimately becomes towards the end of the episode, and then getting to, you know, hit that Voyager reset button and do it all over again.
Are you bad-mouthing Voyager to a guy who hosts a Voyager podcast?
You know I am. I always love to rib you about Voyager, but they really kind of play that card in this episode. They hit that magic reset button, and, you know, it's all good again. You know, even yes. Ben Sisko says I'm okay now, you know. So
take that, you Deep Space Nine loving Voyager hating reset button obsessing fans. There's a reset button right here in this episode of Deep Space Nine.
they definitely use that trope in this episode, but again, that idea of identity over time, I find incredibly satisfying philosophically in the episode. I'm really glad that you thought to talk about, you know, writing and this idea of being in the world. I think that's something definitely there to be appreciated. The idea of being connected to another person, I think, is another really strong theme. There's a lot going on inside this episode philosophically. There is, you know, this kind of moral and ethical play at the end. You can certainly have a meaningful conversation, discussion about self-sacrifice at the end of this episode. And what does that mean? What does that look like? You know, what is the purpose of it? And so I think there's a lot of meat here philosophically. And, you know, for someone who doesn't really want to look at television in a philosophical sense, and they're probably not listening to our podcast, and that's okay. I just say that this has really got something for everybody, because it is a warm, tender episode. There's some science fiction, there's some techno babble. It's a warm story. It's a heartfelt story. It's a great date night episode of Deep Space Nine. Something for everybody.
Older Jake even has a bit of a Captain Ahab complex. He's not trying to slay the white whale, but he's trying to cut the cord.
Absolutely. And if he could have thrust his whole self upon it, he would have.
He thrust his heart upon the batolith. But that Captain Ahab-like quest has been equally self-destructive for older Jake.
It most certainly has. It most certainly has. And but you got to feel for him. And again, I think that he discovered when he became, or really rediscovered, the most authentic version of himself is the moment that, you know, it all came to him, and he was able to do that. And, you know, at the end of the episode, we can all say, yay, they hit the magic reset button. Yay, Jake.
He finally slayed that whale.
Finally slayed the whale, and Ben's okay now. He's okay now. Deep space tissue time. Well, Zach, it's been fun talking about The Visitor and Deep Space Nine today, but this isn't the only thing that we've been discussing here on the network. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
I used to have a pretend phaser, and I used to, you know, I had a tricorder. I was a science officer in my head. I wasn't like Kirk or a Jedi running around saving the galaxy. I was, oh, look at that rock formation over there. Right? You know, so I think, which is ironic, because I'm the least practical person in the real world, so I'd be useless on a science expedition. I'd be a red shirt. If I was in Star Trek, Clara, I'd be a red shirt. I'd be dead as soon as I got on that planet. Right, that's the more realistic depiction of me in Star Trek universe. Right, I'd be the guy killed by the hulking Gorn as soon as I beam down. Oh, I see Crewman Black's dead. Yeah, shouldn't have brought him, really.
Earl Grey.
whoa, you're telling me I can't do the thing that I always do that's bad? Like, I don't know about that. Like, that's a very universal thing when you, conservation, whatever, right? Although I wasn't the biggest fan of the execution and then them completely dropping ball with it or at least just sweeping it on the rug, I should say. They just decided, like, let's talk about it. I appreciate the fact they brought it up at all, honestly. Like, if that had been on TOS, to be honest, they would have never brought it up again, right?
Oh, yeah, gone.
Give us Warp 14 again.
Warp 5.
From Major Carpenter, which is why he calls himself Carpenter. And then he says his first name is John. Jesus Christ, John Carpenter, JCs. And John was a disciple.
His name is John Carpenter? Oh, yeah. My God. I never made that connection. Whoa.
But his previous...
He's made some really good movies.
Just jumped up a few pegs.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
You're killing me. I'm going to pull my hair out if that happens, because I really do need to know.
What if, like, I just had a crazy idea. What if they get the captain in the first episode, but they continue on with these lower deck characters so well that we just never see the captain, and it's like the teacher in Charlie Brown, like...
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please, we'd love for you to leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, no worries, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps. You can also stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Oh, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are a lot of ways that you can mind meld with us. The best place to join the larger conversation is in the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM show and select Metatrex. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/Trek FM. Well, Zachary, when you're not lobbying to get the Defiant out of mothballs, where can people find you around the network and on the interwebs?
I'm all about getting the band back together. Anyone who knows me knows that. Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM show dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager. You can also find me in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook, if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me in there. And you're welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And how about you, Mike, when you're not reaching for your box of deep space tissues... Where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Yeah, I do sit those tissues down and poke my head up once in a while. And when I do, you can always find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. I'm on Twitter as well. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. Love for you to follow me there. If you do, let me know so I can follow you back. I'm occasionally on Instagram, cmichael1701. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It does require a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Well, Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm and captain of our own Defiant here.
And to whom we are all tethered.
Indeed we are.
In subspace.
Executive producers Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp. Aaron Harvey, our art director. Richard Marquez, our production manager. And Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. We'd also like to give a special shout out to our associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, her Twitter handle is at ChocoWeeble. Norman Lau, his Twitter handle is at Starfighter1701. And Mark Walker from Parts Unknown. And Zachary, we'd like to once more invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before. Untethered.